Blair Palmer, and welcome to the Punks in Suits podcast, bringing the leadership thinking, beliefs, philosophies, and practices behind punky, startup-y, next-stage businesses to you, even if your company's not quite there yet. Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of the Punks in Suits podcast. I have an interview for you today, and I think that many of you will find this really interesting. There are, for me, two aspects of developing yourself as a leader right now. The first is to do the inner work, to do the inner development, to really get clear on who you are, what drives you, what gets in the way, how you get in your own way of what you're capable of doing. And the second part of being a great leader right now is being willing to question everything, to put those big questions on the table and look at them in a way that by answering those questions, you may have to change your point of view. It may disrupt the way you see yourself and the world. And I think that those are the kinds of leaders we need now, leaders that are willing to do that. Well, my interviewee this week, Alexander Mayer, has done both of those things. He's rethought his own approach to leadership and the leadership style that he uses and the beliefs that underpin that. And he's also allowed himself to think the unthinkable when he'd taken that heroic, the buck stops with me approach to leadership to its absolute limits.
I had sleeping problems for 3 months, anxieties. I was just felt like I'm on speed, yeah, and I cannot calm down anymore.
So in this interview, he talks really honestly about his career with Saint-Gobain and some of the changes that he's making there as MD of one of their divisions. He talks about his own realizations, about his own leadership, and he gets into depth about what it's really like to help an organization go from a hierarchy to a self-managing or self-directing system. So it's kind of got everything. I should warn you, it's quite long, this interview. So settle in, save it for a nice long car journey or something like that. But I know that you'll enjoy it, and I'll see you on the other side.
Alex, hello.
Hello.
Good to have this opportunity to talk to you again. The reason that I wanted to talk to you is that the theme of these podcasts has been about creating organizations that work in today's and tomorrow's context. This idea that the industrial age, the sort of hierarchical parent-child boss style of leadership won't cut it in today's commercial environment, and that it actually isn't really suited to the culture that's emerging in our organizations and in the world around us. So that's why I want to talk to you. And I'm going to tease our listener for a little bit, because I don't want to explain exactly what it is you're doing straight away. But you are working, you're the managing director of one of the businesses within the Saint-Gobain organization. And this is an organization that's been around really since before the industrial age, 350 years or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So how does an organization like that stay relevant? I mean, what's in its DNA that kind of explains its longevity?
So what is Saint-Gobain makes it lasting so long? I mean, 350 years, think about it. They went through the French Revolution, they went through the First and Second World War, and then it's still existing. And I think one major point, maybe, which is the difference from Saint-Gobain, if you look and observe the stock market of Saint-Gobain, because they're listed in stock market, European stock market, they are not this kind of company you see with 20, 30, or 50% growth. They are this kind of companies who have a growth of maybe 3%, maybe 4, maybe 2, sometimes 1, but steady. I would say one thing, instead of having short-term wins and thinking short-term, and you can optimize the business short-term. I mean, I can, with a facility here in Bristol, I can, within 3 years, I can squeeze any penny out of them and look, make the figures look amazing. Then I move on, and that's super great. Yeah, but for the people and for the business, it's not sustaining. So what I think one difference for Saint-Gobain is they put the focus on long-term sustaining decisions rather than on short-term business decision which can optimize profit for a while, but not really long-lasting. I think this is one difference. And the other difference is Saint-Gobain is able to continuously adapt to the environment. I mean, think about 1680, 1670, what was the environment? The environment was we had real manufacturers, small mini manufacturers who have been masters of something, like glass, this is where Sangaba is coming from, or mirrors. Now to industrial age where knowledge is important, where combining knowledge is important, and the information time and speed what we have right now around us. So this difference are massive. So Sangaba was able over the time to adapt to really what is needed in the new environment which is coming up. And also foresee, so looking maybe 10 years in the future, 15 years in the future, what could be future trends and where we're going. And some businesses, they have left because it was not sustainable. Actually, Sangaba was in the petrol industry. And I don't know whether really people know that, but history, they have been in the petrol industry, but they left it. Say, well, this is not sustaining for us. This is not really the real future. So they have been able to adjust to the environment over time with massive changes within the big organization and corporation as well. And I would say the second pillar is probably they're quite diversified. If you see, Sangaba is actually a habitat business, which is about housing or around housing and making excellence living experience. But if you see our product, which is performance materials and plastics, and we have not even plastics in our part, we are Renko, we're doing tolerance rings, so metal parts. So they try to diversify the business, and when the building business goes down, they have other businesses who are really keeping up. But always going for customized, high quality, high demanding, specialized product. Never ever Sangaba will go for commodity or competing, trying to compete on a mass market. For this, they need to have a certain environment, and this is maybe leads into our conversation we have. What is a new environment, and what is Sangaba adjusting to? And they start. And this may be special as well. Sangaba gives us the ability to try new things. They let us test different models. They let us test different ways of working because Sangaba is our CEO sees that the environment is changing and we need to have new ways of leadership, new ways of operating, new ways of organization. And with their history, they're able to adapt, able to test, able to try and morph into something which is suitable for the future to prepare the next 300 years.
This is so interesting, isn't it? Because we think that our expectations of business today are so cutting edge. So we talk about being entrepreneurial and innovative and sustainable, specialist and high quality, and our attitude to risk becomes really important. Yeah. But actually, you're describing an organization that's had those sorts of values for more than 300 years. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if somehow the sort of industrial age lost its way a bit, that actually a lot of these ideas that we're about to talk about and that are out there in the world of business and leadership now, they're not new. They're just something that we lost along the way, and that actually the early industrialists were risk takers and they weren't too bothered about status and hierarchy. They were just trying to make some great stuff that solved some problems for their society, for their community.
Exactly. So I think when big big names like Ford, Siemens, Otto, Opel, or all these people who created massive organizations, what we see now, if you see Vauxhall, if you see Ford, and et cetera, et cetera, but probably all of them haven't started to say, I want to make a massive money. This was not in their core intention. Yeah, their core intention was maybe for Henry Ford to say, I want to provide every person a car. Every person, not the elite. Every person a car. And maybe for him, for sure, he will make money from it. What was the value? Was the value making money, or was the value providing something to people in the world and people in the US and in other organizations? And what comes first? The first probably comes, maybe depends on where you're coming from, as a laugh as an engineer to solve a problem, or to laugh to provide something for people, which is missing. But it's not coming from, oh, I want to make millions of money. So it starts actually with a purpose, which is much more beyond making money. You know, if you ask me why I'm doing this, what I'm doing in Bristol, and it's a lot of energy, a lot of a personal passion, and sometimes even, like coming home quite late and missing parties and not going out weekends or traveling around to Germany, try to go on conferences to get new knowledge about the topic. Why the hell I'm doing that? practically, I could do it. I could do it 3 years here in England. You know, I'm an expat from Germany. I could sit here easily 3 years, optimize the numbers like in the old style, carrot stick, make it tweak, make it work, make me look nice to get my new job. So why? And there's other purpose behind. And otherwise, probably I wouldn't find the energy. Probably I wouldn't find the drive. Because money is not the drive. And, you know, getting the next nice job, maybe in a higher level or another business, is not my drive as well. And I think this maybe makes a difference and will make a difference in the future, that I have seen businesses and talked to colleagues in other businesses with outside Sangoba and partly inside Sangoba. What is a manager's role when they're moving every 3 to 4 years? Think about it. A manager moves every 3 to 4 years. And he has 3 years in an organization, like an MD in an organization, to prove what he's able to do. All right? 3 years. You need half a year to understand the business. Then you need maybe half a year, 3 months to initiate change. To sustain the change, 3 to 5 years actually is realistic if you do big changes. Yeah. So what I expect actually from an MD within 3 years, I expect from him results, amazing results, optimizing profit, double sales, whatever. And after 3 years, I take him out and put him somewhere else. So what I'm fostering with this kind of behavior is actually short-term thinking. I optimize within 3 years. And how I can optimize within 3 years to look nice? Yeah. It's my old style. Maybe I reduce employees. I increase pressure. I try to lead with stick and carrots. And maybe with fear, depending on. And try to squeeze the organization. Oh, that I when I leave, yeah, the profit is there. Maybe I've made a bit more sales. The company looks nicer. But as soon as I leave, everything falls together. And the next wave comes in with the next manager. And the employees getting nuts. Because a new wave is coming with a new person to prove how nice he is and how good he is. Which is different, completely different, what I think, to, I don't know, the English term for it, but the mid-sized companies in Germany, for instance, family-owned. We have really, really stars in the mid-sized companies in Germany, probably in England as well, where we're between 140, 400, 500, 700 people, employees, family-owned, which are making decisions long-term as well to sustain their business and making long-term decisions rather than short-term decisions, and they can lead completely differently as well.
Maybe it's worth explaining, because we have skirted around it a little.
Yeah.
The experiment, in a way, I mean, I call it an experiment, and I guess it is in the sense that you are figuring it out as you go.
Yeah.
But it's not an experiment in that you're testing the concept, because my understanding is that you really deeply believe in what you're doing.
Yeah.
And the idea basically is that you create a self-managing organization, an organization that doesn't need this strict hierarchy with the MD at the top, kind of setting all the direction and making all the big decisions. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can explain a bit about, in your mind, what that ultimately looks like and where you are in that journey so far.
So, you know, this is really an energetic topic for me. And when I talk too much, please stop me a little bit. And
I might not be able to answer. I'm only here.
Okay, so first of all, I want to help a little bit with some wordings that we get clarity around. I differentiate between self-managing and self-directing. So self-managing could also be that, in my term, that a team receives a clear, let's say, orientation where the company goes, maybe even markets, even giving a rough direction from maybe a leadership team or a strategy team. It doesn't need to be leaders. And then the different teams like production, sales, marketing, or production planning, tool shop, so everything around that, are figuring out their way how to solve this challenge without any leading person in the old hierarchy sense who makes decisions or tell people what to do. So there is a direction, there is about what's a problem to solve, and the team is solving it autonomously without being told which direction, what to do, and how to solve it. This is self-managing for me.
Right. So the direction is set from above, but
exactly.
they work out the how.
Without solutions.
Right.
Yeah? Just saying direction without solutions. Mm. It's sometimes hard. I mean, set a direction without implicitly or explicitly saying how.
And actually, if you don't know how do you even know that that is the right direction or if it's even feasible? So it can create some doubt or mistrust amongst people who say, well, they set the direction, they have no idea how to achieve it, and now they've told us we have to fix the problem.
Exactly. Yeah. And this needs, in a self-managing way, this needs to check in with a group about the goal. So because on the other hand, having 140 people involved in direction setting is a little bit of an organizational challenge. So how we can do this practically? And my vision is for the future that there will be, today this is a management team who's working with in setting the direction together with the first level managers and partly together with employees. But I would say if I set the circle is maybe 10 management team members, two first level managers and two employees sitting together, and we set the direction together, if you see the portion. But in the future, it doesn't mean that the management team need to be the direction setters. It should be people who are interested in strategy and direction setting, who have a natural passion for it. And believe me or not all management team members like strategic work. They hate it. Yeah. So people in the management team have partially people in there which don't like strategy setting and visioning and this outlooking forward in 5 to 10 years and all this stuff. They are in the here and now. They want to go out and do stuff with their teams and help to make the day-to-day better. So it doesn't automatically mean as a management team is able to set, or everybody in the management team is able to set and want to set strategy. Yeah, even they have the best right to sit in the management team with other skills they have. So the future idea is there will be a group of people whose skills and interests are to create strategies, vision, and direction to go for the whole site, and check in with the different groups on site, whether they can see this, why we're going there, and understand and agree or say, well, I don't understand this completely, and then we need to do another circle. So this is for me a bit the future. But the difference for me is self-directing and self-managing is separate from it. And maybe this is a different steps. So having a whole company self-directing, oh, this is an organizational challenge. To bring this, especially within an organization like Sangaba. I mean, you have influencers from Sangaba who gives directions from the business unit, from Sangaba itself, from delegation. So there are a lot of stakeholder influences in the direction, and this need to be somehow brought together and create a strategy and a vision for the site, which encompasses and brings all the stuff together. So in the future, where do I see this organization in the future? I have a medium and a long-term view, personally. The medium term is that we are weakening and blurring more and more the boundaries between management team and first line managers and employees. Mm. So we're melting together already things. For instance, when we set priorities in investment projects we do, buying machinery, building a new building, or whatever we need to do, we're involving already different people from different areas in the business. Well, it doesn't matter whether you're a manager or a leader or not, you can come in and listen and you can give your input and you're welcome. So we're already blurring this typical hierarchy things by inviting people in just to listen. For instance, when we have management team meetings once a month for a day, we're inviting first line managers in and we invite employees in. Yeah, but in terms of practicalities, we cannot invite 100 people and we're inviting maybe two people from each area in to say, okay, two first-line managers, two employees, just to listen, give input. But this is a starting point to get used to this kind of going away from hierarchy, but including more and more people in decision-making, listen to different perspectives, listen to different viewpoints from different areas of the business. Then the question is, when the leaders are not the old-style leaders anymore who makes decisions and telling people what to do, and want to be involved in everything and want to know everything and be the knowers who know as well methods and theories and how to work and being the experts. But what is a new job then? This is the other way where we develop our organization is what will be the future of our leaders? This is important. Otherwise, if you don't give leaders a future perspective, what could it be? Fear comes up, uncertainty comes up. And then this old, maybe holding to the position and defending the turfs is coming up and the areas when I'm not able to give them an outlook of, okay, what will be your job be? What could be your job be? we have a certain journey. We say from a directive leading person, or doing by myself and telling other people, to a manager, to a leader, to a coach, a team coach. Mm. And then maybe you can even dissolve the coach slowly in terms of the organizational level and the organization capability. Some leaders like that. They can see themselves in that journey. And some people say, well, whoa, this is a little bit, well, disturbing in my view where I want to go. And what is the other alternative? The other alternative, they can be good experts again, because they came from an expertise. They have been good in maintenance. They have been good in process engineering. They have been good in design. They have been good in application engineering, really knowledgeable. And some of them went the route because this was the only route to earn more money, being leaders, because the expert route wasn't developed. So to say, they easily looked, okay, when I want to get more money, what do I need to do? I need to get leadership. Okay, let's go the leadership route. But however, in core heart, they're expert about a certain topic. Actually, maybe they don't want to be a leader. They want to be an expert in the topic.
It makes so much sense, doesn't it? Because there are roles that are innately management roles. I mean, I'm thinking about the football team manager standing on the side and of the pitch during the game and shouting out orders and choosing who to send onto the pitch and all of that. So there are those kind of roles, but actually the life of most managers in terms of the management stuff they have to do is pretty gruesome. I mean, it's the boring stuff.
Yeah.
There are some things that are fun, like running a brainstorming session or getting a group together to innovate or to come up with some sort of idea or to solve a problem or whatever. But the kind of day-to-day management of people, the giving of feedback and the often which is critical feedback rather than, you know, support and encouragement, and the sort of moving the chess pieces around.
Yeah.
When I stand in front of an audience and ask the audience, what did you want to be when you were 7? None of them say, I wanted to be a manager of other people. it's no one's ambition, right?
No.
And yet, that is the career trajectory.
Yeah.
But so it makes perfect sense when you don't put ego into the picture. But as soon as you put ego, which we all have an ego, into the picture, and you say, we're going to take that away, that kind of, I'm the boss here now, sort of the thing that feeds the ego, then I can definitely see that people would say, well, what am I working towards then? You know, I start my career after university, I'm 22, 23 years old, and I'm going to work until I'm 65, and I'm, what, just going to be the same as everybody else?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's in it for me?
Yeah, exactly. And if I would see it from this perspective and I was listening to myself, it would tell me that I would be quite boring, actually. However, how we can make this exciting is that before we were coming from an organization where, you know, we had a commercial manager. He was managing internal sales, customer relation, quotes, and all this kind of stuff. What a normal, typical commercial manager does. Then we had a supply chain manager. Supply chain manager was doing purchasing, production planning, and warehouse. Let's take these two examples. And we have this kind of silos where they say, okay, this is my turf and this is my turf. This is where we started 3 years ago. Where we are right now is, for instance, the supply chain manager is now leading a tool room, tool design, tool management. Has nothing to do with his traditional supply chain area where he's coming from. He's still leading warehouse. But what is happening right now is actually people are taking areas over areas of interest because he wanted to get a little bit more knowledge about operations. So we create an opportunity to look into operations and lead areas there. And what he was actually experiencing was, wow, I really need to lead now because I'm not the expert. Because his background is supply chain, nothing to do with tooling. He was empty, white piece of paper in tooling. So the only skill he had was leading, purely not telling, but what you should tell, nothing he can tell. Yeah? And then he learned actually more and more pure leading the team by empowering them, working together with them, finding together out what is our goal, what is our purpose, what we try to achieve here together with them. And they suddenly get a lot of power and passion, and he's developing them to a self-managing team and empower them and help them and coach them. because actually the ability of being the expert is taken away. The second thing is we have the principle of we go there as leaders where we are needed and things need to be improved. So we know, for instance, in our business, we have at the moment a challenge with planning, production planning, but we have people, leaders, commercial leader, for instance, James, who's really interested in that. Instead of telling him, oh, you need to start now in commercial area, what he's doing now, he's giving purchasing back to Duncan, who was there before. He's giving his area of internal sales, he's giving this to a colleague to application engineering, without stucking to it, oh God, I lose now my empire. Yeah, my empire will die. No, he's going now where he's needed with his skills and where he wants to be. And the one important thing here, people are happy to do this, but they are feared and scared of losing money. Yeah, because money is maybe defined by size of teams, level of responsibility of budget I have. And if I tell him, okay, you need to help now with this building this new planning system and helping to bring our production to excellence, but actually you have less direct reports. And if you check your budget, you don't have a budget anymore. And actually, by the way, I need to cut your salary by 15,000 quid. How likely is he to do this happily? None. Why? Yeah. So I think the secret behind is to give people the security to say, go out, do what you want, find your place and give value to the organization, but I don't touch your money. I'm not taking money away when you lose size of leadership, size of group size or whatever. And this is a pitfall. We are sometimes so connected to this hay grading, that the different systems you can do. And, oh, if I change my role now, and they are so looking on, oh, number of people, how many budget responsibility I have, and if I reduce my little empire now, then it goes to hay grading. Hay grading will downgrade me, and then I have 15 less. This will be impact of my family, and they are right. But this stops them to make things happening, what they want and where they are passionate about. So how can I, as a leader, as a managing director, to take this off the table and say, go where you need it. Go where really your passion is, where you make a big difference in value, and experiment, go around and try out. And this is what's happening now. People are shifting between, not only between hierarchies, I said blurring the hierarchy, but also blurring department left and right to say, I'm do a part of planning, which is actually Duncan's area. Duncan is a part of purchasing, which was my area, because they're passionate about these areas. Yeah, instead of having a department to say, oh, this is your department, and this is what you have. If you like it or not, okay. You like 10, you like 80%, but this 20% you must do as well because it's part of the department. No, this 20% can go to a different person.
So you found a way by taking away that sort of very base fear that people have about their income and their sort of progress in their life outside of work. You found a way of taking that, of quelling that fear. What if you discover, or what if they discover that actually, when they really think about what they have to offer, mm-hmm. they're not needed in the organization right now. So mm-hmm. so there is security in this kind of quite strict system that says mm-hmm. this job exists and I do it and I create yeah. something to keep me busy yeah. because that's how everyone works. So the situation you're talking about where people are really thinking, where can I add value? What does the organization really need of me? Maybe the yeah. organization doesn't need me this week or yeah. this year.
Yeah, because, yeah, exactly. It's also a question of where the organization has currently challenges that need to be solved. This is a good question. We have some members of the management team who have this uncertainty of actually where I'm fitting here right now. And there are two options. First of all, we have an atmosphere to address that. So the person can come and say, you know, I need to talk to you because I'm feeling a little bit... I don't know where I fit here, where I can add most value. And this has two reasons. For some of them, they never had where the need to think about this because they were thinking in departments. Mm. I was maintenance leader, process engineer leader, operations leader, and this was defining clearly what to do. And then I can get my head around how to do it. But now it's more like, oh, choose. What do you think we can add value? And it's not clearly departmentalized anymore. It's not labeled by names anymore. So So there's a new way of thinking to follow the heart, follow the emotion, follow what I really want. What is, wow. When I can build my job, what do I really want? We are there. And people can build their jobs, more or less, definitely on management team level, and we bring this more and more down now. And this is a challenge because the question was never there in the past. So we help them with coaching, conversations internally with me or other people, and also external coaching to find their purpose. And funnily or not, we have one member of the team who is now exploring externally what the real passion is. He's helping now a problematic kids who have had problems to integrate in the society again, or close to go to jail or coming from jail or in the jail. And he's now spending every second week, half a Friday, to work with them. So he's exploring what he really likes, what he's passionate about. And maybe this will be his future passion. And maybe his future is coaching internally, or having a half job internally and a half job externally. So to really give them everybody's support to find out what I'm really for, what I'm really striving for. And there's help needed sometimes. The second thing is to say, just try out. Go around, look into health and safety, look into maintenance, look into and get your head around. So there's no pressure to get ready. Yeah, know it now. If you don't know it now, you will fire. Yeah, this is not the way it can work. Confusion takes a little while to get sorted out. And confusion is good because it puts things in question and really refocusing things and really brings you to a new way of connecting to yourself and what do I really want. It's also the responsibility of the person to find out what the person wants. And this is different. If you don't want to be treated as a child and you want to have this parent-child relationship, the parent's telling the child what you want. You want an ice now, yeah? Or you want to sleep now, you want to whatever. Now then take responsibility of your life and think about and find out what you want. Otherwise, you put yourself in a child position. And my role is to create the environment to be able to do this, yeah, and give the best support and the best environment to be able to do this. Is this always working perfectly? Is this always super easy? No, because we have a day to day to run. We have customers to supply, and we have needs on a day to day basis. So both need to work in the same way. So the person has a role and he's supporting the organization to make the day to day happen. At the same time, you need to think about what is my new purpose, what I want to find out. So it's not easy. It's not like retreating, going on a 2-week meditation retreat and think about what I want. So you're in the middle of the day today.
And I'm interested in, because that is such a different way of thinking about yourself and your working life and yourself in the life as a whole. There's something very comforting about being a child. Or in fact, I think that it's not so much that people are children, although the parent-child is the language that we use, but they're kind of teenage. So yeah. They expect to be given lots of freedom, and they expect to be consulted, and they expect to have their say, but then they also want their laundry done. And there is this kind of, that's
and they
like,
want their food somewhere.
Yeah. They eat everything out of the fridge, and then they can't understand why there's anything in the fridge. They're not children like my 8-year-old who just wants me to look after her. There is this kind of tension between what they want, So we're in that kind of stage. And I'm interested in how you got to this point, because my understanding of your background is that it was quite conventional. You did an apprenticeship as a car mechanic, right?
So what's
your attitude towards management and kind of moving up the hierarchy and all of that? It was quite conventional, wasn't it, up until a certain point?
Yes. So when I look back, where I started is actually my father died when I was 8-9ish roughly. My mother was or is still actually a waitress in a restaurant. So the time spending with me was limited. So my grandma, my grandpa died when I was 10, 11. So all my closest relations died when I was quite young. So what I learned at that time is I have my life in my hands. I'm relying, depending on myself. So when I want to make this happen, it's on me. Yeah. Which was in the past very powerful, because I said, okay, I want to do this. I want to earn my money. I want to do that. I did my car mechanic, was finishing the car with the best result in the area. And then I did my next level, the second education, get my qualification to university. And it was about, I was putting on myself to say your strengths, your skills, your abilities, because I learned in the past there were nobody around me who backed me up and I could go to help me. So the fallback was me. And bringing this into an organization worked very well, because there I jumped into positions like as a process engineer, and I was taking responsibility. I looked where weaknesses are, I was improving it. But again, it was about I make it happen rather than people around me I need to take on board. People around me I need to bring on board and make them a part of the journey. And we do it together. It was me, my skills, my abilities, and I shine. I show myself. I because when I show myself, I do get the next job because I can show myself. And in the system, in the organization I was, this was appreciated. So the result I was delivering in my way was appreciated by, wow, well done, because they see things are getting done. So I was really good in getting things done. And I knew how I needed to trigger people, and I knew exactly how I needed to manipulate people in a meeting that I get the outcome I wanted rather than having a facilitated outcome with the group ones. So I was really smart in terms of the pretending of people involvement.
Yeah,
in brackets, but it was more a convincing telling and be argumentative and verbal and strong enough to convince people. Well, I thought I convinced them, which was an artificial convincement, but not really convincement. Actually, I lost them at the end of the day, but I thought I'd convinced them and make things somehow happen by pressure and by pulling strings, but not really by involvement, integration, engagement, and make this way together. However, the organization was rewarding me for that way of working. So, and I thought, okay, that there must be something right with it working that way. So if what you get rewards for, you keep doing. Otherwise, why are you doing it? Yeah. So, and suddenly I got a team leader role. Suddenly I got a bigger team leader role. Suddenly I got, I was an operations manager of an organization of 350 people. I was leading 200 people suddenly. Boing. Yeah, I said, wow, that's amazing. Somehow it works. Yeah, so everything is on me. I know the best. I'm the expert. I'm telling or argumentatively convincing people somehow. And I can and lead with clear goals. I can, when I follow up progress and all these kind of management things, then it works. Yeah, it works to a certain point, until the point you put yourself running into the brick wall and your team members running into brick wall in terms of close to burnout. I could not sleep anymore. I was completely nervous. I was anxieties I had, because at the end of the day, I put much too much pressure on my own shoulders. Because doing it yourself brings also a lot of responsibility to say, when you do it yourself, you yourself have responsibility to make it happen. Mm. It's not shared pressure. It's not shared responsibility. It's on your shoulders. And this brings you down as well. This makes you work crazy hours, makes you try to control everything, makes you try to understand everything, makes you try to be involved in everything. Yeah. And this brings yourself to a limit. Mm. And my limit was reached 2008, 2009. I get divorced. I split from my partner. So everything was connected in this kind of way of living and thinking and behaving. Yeah. And then this was my turning point, my personal turning point, where one or two of my team members were really worn out, and I wouldn't say burnout, but really worn out at the edge. And myself, I said, "Whoa, I cannot sleep anymore. I had sleeping problems for 3 months, anxieties. I was just felt like I'm on speed, yeah, and I cannot calm down anymore." And it's actually, I know maybe some of your listeners know, you can have this kind of sense. It's a drug and a pain. On the one hand side, it's a drug, because when you are successful with this and you can direct and solve and give advices and be the person who solves, this gives you a lot of reward. This gives you the drug you need. Yeah, and this keeps you on speed. This keeps you on this drug. But the moment when your drug is cutting off and you don't get this reward anymore for what you tell people, what you decide, what you make the difference for in this decision, then you get a kind of a cold turkey.
Mm.
Yeah, in terms of what is my purpose now? What is my value? What makes me happy now? What keeps me the energy in my body? And when this is cut off, because you see this is not working anymore, what is left then is a big emptiness. Yeah, and then you need to find your new purpose. So when this is not my purpose and my idea of leading, to tell people to decide, to control, to be involved in everything, to be the expert in everything, what on hell is my new purpose then? So you've taken the drug away. You know this drug is not working anymore. It's bringing you nowhere. But you don't have an alternative. This creates emptiness, scare, anxieties, and really fear. And to overcome this, I did a lot of yoga. I mean, it sounds maybe crazy, but it helped me to calm down, to find myself, to come to myself. I did a lot. I received coaching, and I became a coach. So I did a one-year coaching training. I'm not saying all leaders need to be a coach. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying is it was a big help for me to learn a third discipline. I'm a car mechanic. I'm a master of engineering and an MBA as well. So I know economics. I know technical stuff. But I don't know anything about people. I don't know anything about me, how to lead myself, what I need, what my needs are, what my purpose is, what makes me happy, what is happiness. Nothing about that. I never learned this in life. And I don't know how to lead other people, what other people need, and how people tick, and what makes people tick. So how, and this, I never questioned this my whole life, because there was a saying, it's a belief out there in the organization to say, oh, when you're an engineer, then it's easy to lead people as well. Yeah, because you have done harder things than that. Yeah, and this is a completely misconception that just because you're good at something and you are an engineer and you are brilliant as an expert level, that means you can lead. It means nothing. And for me, my task was, and this is my advantage, I'm a learner. I like to learn and change myself and develop myself. I took this challenge on board to say, what discipline I need to learn to make this work for me and for other people, or I step out of here and I grow flowers. Yeah, so these have been the two options. Either I get my head around or I grow flowers. Yeah. And then I jump into it and said, okay, how I can learn this, and I can learn this, reflect myself and question myself by doing a coaching training and get coaching from other people, help from my coach, and learn to coach. This was my access point to leading in a different way, to and having getting a different understanding. And then I read books, I was in videos on trainings, and from there my curiosity was picked, and then I just went and experimented and tried. But this was a turning point.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because you said that you already had your MBA. Mm. So for a lot of leaders in inverted commas, once they have the MBA, they really think that they are skilled up to lead people. But actually for you, not only was it having this quite dramatic personal experience, the breakdown or the sort of close to burnout, but learning about yourself. Mm. And I think that a lot of leaders think, a lot of managers who aspire to leadership, think that leading people is about learning techniques to get people to do what you want them to do.
Yeah.
Actually, for me, increasingly, and it seems for you as well, leadership is really a personal inner journey. And
absolutely.
It doesn't necessarily end there, because of course you have to understand what makes other people tick too, as you said. But that the big piece of work is around understanding yourself, this massive self-awareness, knowing how you react, what drives you, how to get your needs met, what those needs are, what your values are. And there seems to be so little of that in business, in conventional leadership programs. Is it something that you've brought in to your organization, this focus on self-development and self-growth?
Absolutely. Maybe derived from this learning. I was never really backtracking this, whether this was his instance or not. Definitely, I become a strong believer and a practice person in self-reflection by myself and as teams. So what I started here when I started here in Bristol, I started to build really strongly the management team. And there have been 14 people at that time in the management team. It's quite a big group. Intensively team building, trust building, self-reflecting, and team reflecting, 360-degree reflecting, and be able to talk about on a meta level about things. So and talk about, I was in the first year, I was focusing our conversations 60-70% on the team and personal. And so how we act together, how we work together, how we communicate, trust building, I said how we work and work as a team, and personal development of each member, and maybe 40% on business. From there, it derived a high level of reflection abilities and stepping back and looking on a process, on an organization, on a meeting, on myself to see what's working, what's not working, and let's talk about how we can improve that. And this ability of reflect and to come and create a massive trust and openness to say, you know, I'm struggling with this. Can you help me? I have a problem here. I had a massive problem of stepping back in meetings. I was dominant in meetings and taking over meetings because I had so much to say, I thought, that I know stuff. I want to show that I know, I want to help. But with this, I was dominating. And people were telling me that. So we created an atmosphere where people were able to tell me that. I could open, say in my team to the guys, I know I'm a hell of a nightmare in meetings. I know I cannot just shut up. It's hard for me to, but could you help me with this? I need some help. Give me a sign or whatever that I'm not taking over here. So to be able to create this honesty, it's one on the one hand side, a big relief because you can be yourself. You bring your complete self to the meeting and to the organization because you don't need to fear that you put your vulnerabilities on the table. Because saying I'm a dominant person sometimes, I can take over meetings, and this is probably not really nice for you, it's a vulnerability. I mean, put this and share this with the team. And other people have other stuff. One had a challenge to delegate. One had a challenge for self-managing and time management. One had a different challenge for different things. And being able to reflect this, being aware of these challenges, is the first step to making the change for yourself happen. And then having help maybe for external coaches or internal coaches to make the change happen is the next step. But this kind of environment was created from the beginning of my journey. I focused a lot of time, as I said, 60%, 70% of my time with the management team intensively to build this kind of atmosphere and understanding, which is paying out now when we make the changes happening, because we are able to step back in critical situations. We are able to reflect when we have conflicts or tension in our teams to step back and say, what was actually happening here? What created that? And what we can do different next time instead of just swallowing it and giving it build up and getting more aggressive. And I figured one rule out for me is a belief, and this is my belief. An organization can only develop to a certain level, and this level is limited by the development level of the leaders. If I'm a manager type leader who is working with KPIs, with numbers, with tools, as you said, and try to lead with methods, with SWOT analysis, by KPI, by goals and objectives and all that stuff, and I'm very directive, I'm making decisions, I want to make decisions, I want to be involved, then the organizational development level is limited by that. People inside the organization who want to come up and try to do different things will be blocked or are blocked by this development level of this kind of highest leadership hierarchy who will stay in the system.
Yeah. I love that. I love that idea. And it's so, when I think about situations I've been in where I've been working with an organization that needs to change and the leadership team is saying, why won't our people change? And I reflect back, well, because you guys aren't changing. And it's not because somehow you need to model it. It's not as simple as that. It's not about walking the talk exactly. It's about your organization, as you say, cannot be more sophisticated than you are. And so however undeveloped you are, that's your organization. Yeah. However developed you are, that's your organization.
Correct. And just I have a really basic example for that where I say, well, this is, for me, maybe the lowest level of example is, I hear often organizations saying, oh, okay, our organization need to be more innovative, right? And we now introduce facilitation with creative facilitation of sticky notes and brainstorming and maybe six hats from De Bono and all this kind of stuff. And I say specifically, they need to use these tools to be more innovative, right?
Yeah.
And then suddenly, some of their people sitting with you in a meeting, and you work in the old way. You're not using sticky notes. You're not using pictures. You're not using warm-up exercises. You're not, how does it work? This cannot work. So how truthful and honest you really mean what you say, that you want to change an organization, be more innovative by using these tools when you're not applying it by yourself. And this is a mini, mini example of hundreds other attitudes, feeling, and how you show how an organization should be. And there's a big difference for me to say, oh, we should do this, or they should do that. And to say, no, 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 this was my principle from the beginning. We go there first.
Yeah.
We go there first, and then the organization will follow. But if we say they should, this is not working.
And what do you think it is? So, you know, if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, okay, you know, I get it. I see. It makes perfect logical sense that. But, you know, there are a million reasons why I can't change the way I do it, or why we can't change the way we do it. Sangaman's a different environment. Alex is a different kind of person. He's had this experience I haven't had. I can totally understand someone listening to this and thinking, yeah, sounds good, but it's different for me. What would you say? What would your response be to that?
My response is fear of change. It's a very hard and maybe overused word. As you say, it's more, I would explaining, it's a reluctancy to come from a state A, which is known to the person and works to a certain extent, even if the results are horrible. Yeah. Even if, you know, work life is horrible, fighting at home, no time for family. Internally, you need to push a lot of stuff. You know, you are put a lot of energy in things. You have fights with your colleagues, or maybe even not. Maybe it's just a convenient flow. Everything is fine. But it's coming from this known world to something I don't know yet. Mm. And this is leaving something I know, even if it's painful and horrible, to something I don't know, but could be better or could be different.
Or could be worse. That's obviously the fear, right? Yeah.
Yeah, could be worse. And making this step out of the known into the unknown, this is for me actually the reluctancy of change. And a lot of people connecting different things to it. It doesn't mean fear. Mm. It doesn't mean losing convenience. It means eventually to invest more time first, or going to the unknown means experimenting, exploring, and not explorer. So there are a lot of stuff, or I have no time, or, you know, I'm fearing I get lost in it, I'm losing my way, or if I don't know the new world, what will it be? So why on a hey, I should go there? Why? And there are only two reasons for me, and I've come across only two reasons why people change. There must be a massively positive outlook, or there must be currently such a high pain, yeah, that I want to change. Mm. And I believe at the moment that the pain, you know, we try to convince a lot of times about, oh, this could be so nice, you could be better work-life balance, you could be a much more chilled person. I sense at the moment, with the experience I have, people are more likely to change when they have higher pain. And this is, I don't like this, but I experienced that, and I experienced
exactly what you experienced, yeah.
Yeah. When you are on the edge, when the organization is on the edge, when whatever reason, there are certain moments in your life where you make the internal decision to say, I need to do something different. I want this energy is big enough to overcome my known to something unknown. This energy must be big enough to do this jump, to do the step out of that. Mm. And this is either created by something really, really nice and good, or by really painful, I need to move. And I actually did a combination of both in the organization. So by using, for instance, as an example, a facilitator. So our organization was led by firefighting chaos. People have been, my management team have been overworked, completely no life balance anymore, worked in silos, tensions and fighting to each other. It was an elbow organization, a little bit like that. I went in and said, okay, I saw that you're on the edge. So with a team building exercise, 2.5 days, and I brought them in, they hated to come in. They reluctantly said, oh, no, it's a waste of time. We have so much to do, and spending 2.5 days outside is horrible. It's nuts. And I said, I'm the boss. I tell you, we go there. Whatever.
You used that. You used that. I was
explaining all the advantages, all the stuff why we should do this. But the day to day was so powerful. They said, we don't have time. We don't have time to sharpen our axe to be more efficient. This was not there. They said, okay, we must be there. Let's go out. And we created such a positive experience of talk, release of all these emotions and sticking together and create an atmosphere where they are trust and they talked about the history and they suddenly melted together closer. And this created a positive experience for them, a positive outlook, how it could be by just experiencing it. So the energy was there to change, but they didn't want to go this step because they're stuck into the day-to-day. I helped them, encouraged them, told them to go into this experience. Experience a positive something, I would say, wow, this could be really different. And then with this kind of starting point, I was leading differently. I open up, I was trustful, I was gave them responsibility, was more a coach rather than a teller. And they say, wow, this is really nice. So by experiencing it differently, they experienced a positive and they went more with it. Other people in my management team, I needed to bring them to the edge to create even more pain for them to make the change. To say, they have been completely overcommitting. They're not delegating anything to the teams. They're not involved the teams at all. Everything was on their shoulders. So I raced and said, okay, you want to have another project? Perfect, you get another project. You get more tasks on board? Perfect, get this task. And I was asking where the deliveries are. Where is that? 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 Until the point that they came to me and said, Alexander, I cannot do it anymore. I said, bravo. We're here now. Yeah? Okay, so let's talk now. Are you ready? Let's talk now.
So you were a bit of a bastard.
Yes.
You pushed them to the point of break. Yeah.
Because, you know, telling him you are not delegating, telling him to say it would be helpful to involve your team was not getting through.
No. You had to make the pain. So you had to be such a pain in the ass to them that in the end they could take no more.
Yeah. But having a real close observation of where are they and support them with help immediately when it was needed. So not drop them.
Yeah.
This needs intensive work to help them to come to this insight. But when the insight comes, there must be help, support, and offer to say, okay, understand it's the edge now. So what are we going to do now? And some people, this was an extreme curve. For some people, it went easy. How it depends on what personality you are. You need a lot of people can stand a lot of pain before they do moves. And other people just, well, this is uncomfortable. I want to do something about it. Let's change. So what I can do here? And it's really different from you from person. Some are motivated by the positive outlook. Some are need a little bit more of this pain feeling. I cannot do more. It's really different from person to person. However, if you want to make this change happen, we as leaders cannot stay where we are. Otherwise, we're not developing our organization. Or we assume ourselves as super developed already and a kind of a shiny holy grail of everything. And okay, but I'm not there yet. And probably we will hear the same from the management team that haven't been there yet as well. So.
It's interesting. Yeah. I'm thinking about my definition of leadership, and to me, a leader as opposed to a manager or just someone who calls themselves a leader but isn't really leading. A leader is someone who looks at what is and what could be and then disrupts the status quo to bring about change, which is exactly what you did. And I'm curious, and you had to draw on a style of leadership which was almost anti what you truly believe in order to create that outcome. But you were so committed to the outcome that you did what it took.
It depends on how much time you have. So if you have an organization which works, everything is fine, you have a steady income stream, and you say, okay, we need to develop maybe the next 10 years to something different. So maybe your speed and the time you have to make this change happen and bring people to the insights and convincing them slowly to a different way of working, maybe you can even use a different approach for that. If you have 3 years or even less because the business is in chaos in brackets or has a drop down of results and we need to do something about it, otherwise the organization will close down or have significant problems, then you need to accelerate. And this is why I said, okay, it's a mixture for me to, for some people need a little bit more pain, more need to change, some need more positive outlook and maybe a combination of it. But it also depends on how much time we have.
So the only thing that I can see that is a question for me, and it's partly because I haven't met your guys, is whether you have managed to create within the organization leaders who are as passionate and committed about it as you, to the extent that they would go to the lengths that you were willing to go to.
Yeah.
Because as you say, firstly, you're not going to be there forever. And secondly, even if you were there, that would kind of defy the point. You know, the whole point is not to be led by a charismatic leader and to do it all because you're so inspired by them, but to find the inspiration from inside. Yeah. So I understand that they get it and that they care about it hugely. Yeah. Do you think that you've managed to create in them that level of commitment that they would put themselves into the position that you have been willing to put yourself into?
I would say it depends. Within the management team, I would say 80% yes. They would keep it going because they, for instance, there are a lot of nice things coming with this and a lot of positive developments with this. As I said, they can do where their passions are, where they feel valued, where they feel they make a difference. So there is a lot of freedom and a lot of having fun and joy with this in work, there's no clocking system. There's nobody who's telling them and approving holidays anymore. So there's a lot around this, which gives a lot of a positive atmosphere and the reason why to be here and why to keep it going. And I would say it's a little bit like, I think they wouldn't stand any other organization form anymore because they wouldn't get crazy. If now we would change back to hierarchy and people tell them, they would just get freaked out. Because they have experienced this new way and really get the smell and the taste. How could it be? And now turning back, it's really hard. So I would say yes, 80% definitely, 100% on board, and it would be hard to turn the wheel back because of just of their personal experience. And probably if this would happen, probably they would leave. So there's a kind of a momentum going within the management team to keep it going. Just they are so much fun and excitement about it. And this is a problem for me as well. Once you have experienced the different way of working and you're really into it and you develop yourself to a different level, different state and a different awareness of different values and how it could be, and you're experiencing it how it could be, and even we are not there yet, I mean, this is even more to come, can I really imagine myself to go back in the hierarchy? I would get crazy, I would nuts. So a little bit, I'm burned in that, you know.
Yeah, it's ruined. It's ruined you for anyone else.
Yeah. So, and the real positive thing is my boss and my boss and the organization we are in are really fostering and supporting this way of working. So the likelihood that a management director or another person comes in, which really ruins everything, is really low. And actually, there's a higher likelihood that we just keep it going.
I remember when I got my first job at the BBC, and my parents said, "Now, congratulations! Obviously, mm-hmm. Your job is to make yourself indispensable."
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like you're doing the complete opposite. Yeah. Your job is to make yourself completely dispensable.
Yeah.
So what's next then? What at the point at which they don't need you or they need to then live without you, what next?
And this is what I ask my team right now. I ask the open question, in what area I can add the most value? So where could I be the best servant for the organization? And we have open conversations about this and the best. I was the best servant for the organization to give direction and foster the change and initiating things and getting this started. But this is now rolling. So, and what is my new role then? So where can I add value without stepping on other people's toes and just, again, do stuff what other people could do? And it's more being more and more individual coach, being more and more overlooking the, I would say, the overall cultural development and help the management team to see where we are culturally not developed yet and where we need to do the next steps. So I'm quite good in seeing the trees in the woods. I don't know whether this translates into English. And to see what is coming, looking long term, and help the team to develop the skills to do this by their own. This is at the moment a gap I have, or the gap we have is me as a person, not as an MD. I'm not because I'm the MD. Because me, Alexander, I have a certain skill set. And the skill set is seeing the trees in the woods and be able to look out to what is coming and where we need to adjust and where we need to develop in what areas, organizational wise. Mm. And the question is, who can take over this role in the future? And it's not the MD, it's a person. It can be HR, it can be a different person, doesn't matter who. Well, what gap need to be filled to keep this? Because it's a crucial part to develop further.
Because certainly what I'm hearing is that you've got an organization of people who can absolutely keep the momentum going. Yeah. And they're committed to keep the momentum going. But what you have that's a little different is the willingness to disrupt momentum.
Yes, exactly.
And that is a different quality, and that is not necessarily something that everyone is going to be willing or able to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how much is this needed still, and how we create this without me?
Well, I mean, you could probably definitely talk about this for a whole other day.
Yes.
But unfortunately, we have to stop. But it's been fascinating, and I'm sure that anyone listening to this, it will really have got them thinking about what is stopping them from finding, and it won't necessarily be your way, you know,
but
finding a way to overcome the limitations that are sort of baked into the way we run business today. Yeah. And that journey seems to start, from what you're saying, with themselves. It doesn't start with restructure. It doesn't start with thinking about self-organization or self-management or self-direction or any of those things. It starts with their own self and that inner work. Yeah.
And I like this. There was a question from a good coach to me. Is he asked me the question, how do you create your own problems?
So
how do you create your own organization you see right now? And this is a quite powerful question to yourself, which hits your face and say, well, why? No, this is the people are creating this.
<Not me. laughs> Yeah. But actually, to what extent is it you? Yeah,
exactly, creating this, right? And the other part I want to say to the end is, everything what I'm saying right now, I've told you in the last, 1.5 hours we talked here, is my truth, is my reality. And it's maybe completely wrong, because this is how I have saved it in my head, and my explanation tries how it worked or not worked. And if you ask 140 people in the organization, they have 140 pictures in their heads. And so I don't want to leave this as, this is the truth. This is my truth. This is my way I explain it. And it can be for other people completely different. Different things are needed. And it's not the magic way. I just share my experience in that sense.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's also part of the mindset, isn't it? That there is no right answer.
Yeah.
It's just the way we're doing it, and we're going to see.
Right.
Well, Alex, thank you very much. It's been a huge joy to talk to you and to listen to your ideas
thank
today.
You. It was amazing.
What a lovely chat. One of the things I really like about talking to Alex is that he's not a stereotypical teal leader. He definitely learned the hard way. He was raised in the command and control leadership school of hard knocks. But I'm sure that we'll be talking to him again and finding out how things are going over there at Saint-Gobain. So that's it for this week. I will hand over now to the lovely Ivy Palmer to summarise some of the key points from today.
The best leaders don't focus on creating followers. They focus on creating more leaders. If you were going to make your own role redundant over the next 18 months, what would you need to change about your leadership style? And remember, the organisation can only be as developed as you are. So, focus on your own development first. Please remember to comment, review, and share this podcast with all your friends. It's not just leaders who benefit when they're rethinking their leadership style. It's their whole organization.